You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Talk Back. I'm your host, Christine Toy Johnson. We're giving you a special gift for the holidays, a never-before-released live episode that we did at BroadwayCon in New York City in July of 2023. I had the great joy of sitting down with my longtime pal and colleague, Danny Burstein. Danny is a treasured and prolific actor on film, television, and Broadway. He's been in 19 Broadway shows, with the latest being Pictures from Home by Char White, which he was starring in at the time of this recording. In this special episode, Danny and I talk about how his career as an artist intersects with his passion for activism. He also shares lots of stories from behind the scenes of some of his most famous roles. Welcome to this live episode of the Dramatists Guild's Presents Talk Back. I'm your host, Christine Toy Johnson. Just wanted to let you know that because it's live, we encourage you to laugh or applaud ferociously for him, whatever you want to do.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. And yes, this is my dear friend, Tony Award winning, amazing everything, Danny Burstein. Danny and I go way back. We met during the first revival of Merrily We Roll Along.
They liked it too.
They're applauding. Yeah. It was in 1994 at the York, and right. A lot of people know that production from the album cover, actually. If you say it's the blue album cover with the clock on it, people know that's our show. Right. And I believe that we had some very special roles, moving furniture. There was an incident with a plant. Do you remember?
No.
Oh, really?
No. Okay. Tell me. I'll interview you.
Okay, so this cast was amazing because not only did it produce you, but also Tony Award winner Michelle Pach and Tony Award winner Adrian Lennox, where the plant incident comes in. You don't remember?
You'll tell me and I'll remember, okay. I'm sure.
So this set had a couple of different levels.
I remember instead of singing That Frank, we started singing That Plant.
Yes, you don't remember why, though. Okay, so we had a lot of different things to move, furniture, props, and everything.
Right.
And you were on the upper level, and Adrian was on the lower level doing a scene, and you were moving a plant and dropped it on her head.
Oh, my God. That's why I don't remember. Wow.
You don't remember that?
No.
She was fine. Everything worked out.
Wow. I'm surprised. I see her a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that she doesn't bring that up.
And I also remember that, so the set and the theater is very small.
Yeah.
And the stage left, quote unquote, wing space was like a crawl space. And sometimes we had to wait in this crawl space together, waiting to go on and trying not to be the peanut gallery for what was going on stage, I'll just say that. Mm-hmm. And I think we really bonded there because you're crouched into this little space waiting to go on. And we were the hottest ticket in New York that summer.
That's true.
Yeah. Yes, but that's the glamour of show business.
Right. And we were all making, nothing.
Yeah. Like
$198 a week,
maybe,
I think it was.
Maybe, yeah. But it was really fun, and
I had a blast. I loved doing that production.
Yeah, me too. It was really special.
It really was.
There are a lot of things I wanted to talk to you about. So I feel like you and I have a similar story in that we both started out in this business a long time ago when we were young. And we both, I think, grew up in the New York City area.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about...
Sure. I grew up in New York City. I was born in the Bronx, and then we were living in the Bronx. I was born in Mount Kisco, actually.
Really? Not because I never knew that.
Yeah, not because...
My family lives right near there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So my grandparents on my father's side lived there, and my parents were visiting. And I wanted to be born in Mount Kisco. That's where I was born. Not because we lived there, but because that's where that's where I came out. Yeah, so to speak.
Yeah. That's so crazy.
Yeah,
yeah, my family lives in Katona, New York, which is not very far away from there.
And then we moved when my dad got a job teaching at Queens College when I was about 5 or 6 and moved to Queens, moved to Flushing. And that's where I lived. My parents still live in Flushing. And my dad just recently retired from Queens College. But I grew up in the city. And when I was 13, I was lucky enough to audition for the High School of Performing Arts.
Okay.
And that changed my life. I had a teacher. I was very lucky. I had a teacher in junior high who, you know, who said, I think you got something. And I said, you should go to the High School of Performing Arts. And I said, great, what's the High School of Performing Arts? And he explained it to me and told me, it's a fantastic school. Ben Vereen went there and Liza Minnelli went there. And you just have to audition with a couple of monologues. And I said, great, what's a monologue? I really had no idea about any part of that. I loved reading plays because my dad gave me plays. And I was lucky enough, the year I auditioned, well over 4,000 people, kids, school kids, auditioned, and 127 made it in.
Wow.
And I had no idea what I was doing, but I was lucky enough to get in.
Do you remember what your monologues were?
One was from Dead End, and the other one was from The Time of Your Life, William Saroyan.
Wow.
Yeah.
Growing up in the city, did you also go to see Broadway shows while you were...
Not really. My teacher from junior high school brought me to my first Broadway show. And that was A Chorus Line.
Oh, yes.
And my mind was blown.
Yeah, like, same.
They just said, fuck. It was amazing. And they were saying things that I was feeling, but I didn't know other people felt.
Yeah.
And they were going through all those changes that I was going through.
Yeah.
So I thought, boy, I want to be there.
Yeah.
And all of it just spiraled, and I got lucky. I really did. And those 4 years at the High School of Performing Arts really changed me and shaped me. And my plan was always to be the next Marlon Brando. That's what I really wanted to do. And all of a sudden, I was in college, and my teacher there was the executive producer at the Muni in St. Louis, Ed Greenberg. Mm-hmm. And he said, why don't you come and do a season at the Muni? I think you're great. And I was 19, and I thought, okay. But I never really done much singing. I didn't know any dancing, really. And not really. I never took a lesson. And they said, do you tap? I was like, yes, I do. And I just learned by doing it.
Wow. Do you remember the first shows you did that season?
My first equity show there, where I got my equity card, was The Music Man with Jim Dale, who's still a very good friend, and Pam Dauber.
Wow.
From Mork and Mindy. And she was wonderful. She has a gorgeous soprano voice. She took over
Linda Ronstadt.
For Linda Ronstadt in Pirates, years ago. She was wonderful.
That's amazing.
Yeah, great, great voice and terrific human being, yeah. Yeah.
I remember going to see A Chorus Line 6 times, I think.
Yeah.
And back then, also, it was very affordable to go to standing room and just to keep going to shows. And,
But it was one thing I do want to mention, the importance of starting out that way and starting out in the chorus and starting out knowing very little initially was that spirit of being an apprentice and really learning from everything around me and knowing that I wasn't ready to be a lead just like that. I needed to build my resume up and I needed to build my skills up. And that truly shaped me also because I wanted to just be in the background. I wanted to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
One summer at the Muni, I did Shenandoah with John Cullum.
Wow.
And I just sat in the wing and watched him sing his meditation numbers. Every night, every show, I would sit there in one, right in the wing. And I learned so much from all those people.
I think that's so amazing. And also how lucky I think we both were to start out and have role models that we were working with to watch. And not only about to witness the great talent, but also professional courtesy and kindness and all of the things that you hope to, that you aspire to embody, right? Yeah.
And so I learned all those things. And when I'm working with younger actors now, I do my best to give back in the same kind of way.
Yeah.
I learned that very early. Both my parents are teachers. I've told this story many times, but when I was 18 at Queen's College, I was cast in Merrily.
Oh, you were?
Who
were you?
I was playing Frank.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and I knew nothing about musicals. I knew nothing about anything. And the script was famously flawed and difficult, and there were three different versions of it, and it had only closed on Broadway like 3 months before. And so
you got to do it then.
Greenberg was directing it. And so I was lamenting to a friend at school saying, I don't know how to play this role. He seems like such a shit. How do you make him followable? Mm. How does anybody want to see his journey? And he said, you know who you should ask? You should ask Stephen Sondheim. And
I went, sure.
Sure.
I'll just call him up.
And he said, no, I have his address here. And so I wrote Sondheim a letter.
And of course he wrote back.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
And I wrote like 25 questions.
Wow.
And he said, dear Danny, all those questions would have to be answered in a letter the size of War and Peace. But here's my number. Give me a call and we'll get together. And I cut to me at his place, his townhouse. I'm walking in. Lapine is walking out. They're writing Sunday in the Park. And I go, hello. Hi. And he says, have a seat. He goes upstairs and comes back a minute later with a carafe of white wine about that size, puts it on the table in front of us, and puts two glasses down, and he says, okay, what do you want to know? And we spoke for the next 3 hours. And if my thinking was and is, if Stephen Sondheim could do that for me, the least I could do is give back.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
When I get the opportunity to, yeah.
So we're really here, ostensibly, really. We can talk about a lot of things. But
sure.
We're here to talk about artivism in action.
Right.
How we can use our art to amplify things we believe in. Because you are in a position now where you can choose what kinds of parts you want to play. And I wanted to start with asking you, what goes into those decisions, how you go about choosing the kinds of stories you want to tell?
Well, that I am very lucky that I'm in this position. It only took me 40 years in this business.
you're such an overnight success.
To get to this place where I am often offered jobs. And I think artists have to be artist activists, and I think we have a responsibility to what stories we do tell. And I never know what is going to come across my desk, what I'm going to see, what story I'm going to read, but I want it to be something valuable. Right. And that has to do with what it's saying, whether it's just a story about, for example, Pictures from Home was a family story, and that touched me. This guy, and he died tragically, young. But he was this incredible artist who was trying to do something that maybe no one had ever done before. That's fascinating to me. And even in other works that I've done, like Fiddler is such a beautiful story, but it's really about immigrants and people being forced from their homes and strife. Man's inhumanity to man, and that unfortunately will never go and will always resonate. And I thought that was an important thing, an important story to tell. And even just basic human things, people falling in love, simple stories that resonate, that's important. But also, as far as that goes, being having a little bit of notoriety, having a certain following on whatever social media, you try to do your best to spark conversation and have people think about what's really going on in the world mm-hmm. without leaving anybody behind. Mm-hmm. And that's the toughest part,
that's
because
the challenge,
people are so separated mm-hmm. Now, our country is. Mm-hmm. It's hard to not alienate people as you're saying, hey, this is science, as I was doing this morning, marching for climate change this morning in Union Square, because that world clock was ticking and ticked mm-hmm. down to 5 years. That means that we have 5 years to do something about climate change before it's irreparable. And there were about 50 people who showed up, and they were saying, oh, this is a much better turnout than last year, mm-hmm. where only about 15 people showed up. Mm-hmm. But it's so important, it's because it's the planet, and it's all we have. I do things like that to think, not with the thought behind it that, oh, I have to influence these people, but just because I think it's the right thing to do.
Sure, yeah.
And that's always my spark, whether choosing something to do or getting involved in a certain project, because it has to hit me in a certain place, in my heart and in my brain.
Yes, yes.
It has to really influence me, or I have to care about it deeply.
Yes, absolutely. I think that because we are talking as part of the Dramatists Guild, I want to throw in this piece of the puzzle that I think that for writers, choosing what stories to tell is, of course, key to, we're going to spend years and years developing an idea and a project. And there, it also feels like a responsibility to not only write about something that you're really passionate about, but that hopefully can have some kind of impact, that can say something indelible and that will provoke thought. The original, I think, impulse of theater is to provoke thought, illuminate ideas, put a mirror up to society, right? And it seems like there's so much going on these days about the cancellation of stories or the erasure of parts of history. And I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit, about how I know you're very outspoken also about standing up against censorship and against those kinds of things. If you can speak a little bit about that and what kinds of thoughts you have.
I remember, forgive me, Donald Trump is, I'm not a fan. And I remember running into Douglas Carter Bean 2 days after he was elected. And I accosted him on the train. You know, he's an old friend. And I said, are you writing about this? You have to write about this. I honestly think, it's not just because I think it, it is because it is a fact. It all starts with the writer. Every incredible idea starts with the writer. And they need our support and they need our encouragement. And they're the ones who are creating new pieces of art so that we can take them and run with them. And I think it all comes down to that. I guess it was just because of my dad where I got that idea. My dad was a protege of Philip Roth, and he took classes with him initially at the University of Iowa in their master's program. It just, the idea of the writer and reading, and then everything jumping off the page for me, reading plays as a kid, I have the most respect for the writer in the room. If ever I'm intimidated by anybody in the room, it tends to be the writer, because you have to give it up to them. Yeah. It was their idea. They're the reason we're in the room. They have that ultimate responsibility to start the ball rolling, to get the right things out there, the right ideas out there, and to have an opinion. Mm-hmm. That's another thing. I think you, as artists, we have to have an opinion. You walk in the room, how am I going to play this role? I want to make the juiciest choice, the choice that will make the most impact with the values that I hold dear. I think everybody in the room has that responsibility.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I remember, I've been serving on the Council of the Guild since 2016, and I remember going into a meeting with some of my personal heroes, John Weidman and Lisa Crone, and, yeah. and I just went in, it was right after the election of 2016, and I said, we have to write about democracy so it's remembered.
Right.
And it's sadly, yeah, sadly something.
I was doing Fiddler at that time, and I remember especially, and understandably, the young girls in the company came in weeping that next day. And of course, it was a Wednesday. We had a matinee. And for the next, I don't know, 3 or 4 days in singing If I Were a Rich Man, when I got to the point where it said, when you're rich, they think you really know. I looked at the audience and everybody in the audience groaned like, oh God. And I wanted to go right there with you. Believe me. Yeah, it was all mixing at that moment.
Yeah.
And they said some important things, needless to say.
Yes, yes. That's why Fiddler, I think, is a classic, too, in so many ways, because all the layers of
that show continue on.
Yeah.
And just, mentioning that poor, that incredible Sheldon Harnick recently passed away. What an amazing human being he was. He was
a legendary force.
Yeah, he'll be missed, needless to say.
He also served on the council for a very long time and always gave back to the community of writers, which is a testament to his spirit, too.
Yeah, his strength and wanting to take a stand.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We all have that, whether we're artists or not. We all have the responsibility mm-hmm. to speak out and take a stand.
Have you ever received pushback for anything that you've said publicly?
Certainly on social media.
Where people feel like they can just say anything, right? Yeah.
Yes, people do. And sometimes you go, this can't be a human being I'm speaking of. It must be a bot. It must be something, because no one is that ridiculous or mean.
Yeah.
I just pray it is and go, block. No. Why not? You know, life's too good to spend on those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Yes, but every once in a while you do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you run into somebody who works in the business, which is shocking. And then you have to work with them, but you also maybe avoid speaking about those subjects. But it's tough. It's tough because it comes into play in everything.
Yeah, I want to talk about that actually a little bit.
Please.
How we can foster difficult relationships or relationships that circle around difficult conversations, opinions, ideas. Because I think that you are so intrinsically kind and welcoming and a bridge builder. And so I wonder how you navigate that if you're in a situation where you're working with someone you know you don't share the same opinions, but you do have to work together.
Yeah, at work, it's professional. You're professional. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you become friendly with these people. There was a person at Cabaret when I did that show around 10 years ago at Studio 54 who worked backstage and who has kids, and we were talking about guns. And shooting machine guns and AK, whatever, automatic weapons. And he was saying, and at that particular time, there was a string of all these school shootings. Mm-hmm. And I was just shaking my head backstage because it's so unnerving. Little children are being murdered at schools, which is still impossible to quite wrap your brain around. That is a thing that happens in our country often. And I said to him, expecting him to go, of course, yeah, it's a very bad thing. And I went on this sort of, I guess, a long rant about it and how sad it was. And he said, I don't know. Have you ever shot one?
Wow.
And I went, no. But I don't have to. I know that people are getting hurt. And I said, and my friend, you have two children, two little kids. Aren't you worried about that? Not really. But He's having said that, he's a great guy. He really is a really lovely human being who would give you the shirt off his back. But we definitely disagreed about that subject. But it does slightly make you think differently. You can't help it. But I don't forget the fact that he is also a good person who I think is just wrong about this subject. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, people who are wrong about that subject have control of that subject right now. Mm-hmm. And many people, not just little children, but many people are paying the price for that opinion. And that's where we really couldn't get into that kind of an argument. Mm-hmm. Because it becomes a question of morality at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And that's always the toughest thing. The precipice you're not sure you want to go over.
Yeah. And I think really difficult to agree to disagree in a way.
Yeah.
Which I think is so absent from a lot of our national dialogue.
Yeah.
The trying to come together over our commonalities instead of our differences. To remember that the humanity is what is the most important thing to center.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do love him. I do. But
yeah, that's so interesting.
Tough.
What other ways can we use our art for good?
I started in the business when I was 19, as I said, and immediately I was 1984, and immediately all the people that I started working with were dying. Mm. These young, beautiful men were dying. Even in their 40s, they were like 22. And it was devastating to have this happen to these beautiful human beings. And so I immediately jumped into helping Broadway Cares. It was two different companies, two different organizations at that time, Broadway Cares and Equity Fights AIDS, before they merged. And I put my energies into that because that was the only way I knew how to help. And once you've lived through something like that, you have no other choice. And then you get to a certain level and people start going, oh, yeah, you should, can we use your name for this? And can we put you on our letterhead? And I say yes, because I care very much about the things I'm passionate about.
Right.
And that is one that I'm very passionate about. And anytime Tom Viola calls, who's an amazing human being, anytime he calls, I do my best to do anything he needs me to do, to speak or whatever he needs. I'm there for him because of the way I grew up. And because Rebecca passed away from ALS, I'm vocal about that issue. I speak and I raise money on behalf of Project ALS. Rebecca she did a concert and she raised $250,000 before she passed away. Singing, she could barely she had to hold herself up on her arms.
It was beautiful.
I think so too.
Beautiful.
I think so too. And she literally had to hold herself up so she had enough lung capacity to be able to sing. Yeah. And literally a week after she did that, she could not have done it because she was going so quickly, unfortunately. Life thrust that upon me.
Right.
And so I give back in that way as well. All of a sudden we're in the middle of a SAG after strike
because
we need to stand up for ourselves and stand up for all the people in the industry who are being wronged, including, of course, the writers. Mm-hmm. And so was out there yesterday marching, trying to do what I could to lend my voice and to make other people aware of it and to not let the big corporations get away with the outright greed that's going on right now. Mm-hmm. And so that needs to change. And if I find a subject that I care deeply about, I make it my business to speak out about it.
How do you balance all of that?
And sleep.
Yeah, it's a lot. It takes its toll on you.
Oh, my God,
it takes its toll. And you're balancing not only all of the things that you care about and wanting to amplify them and wanting to do what you can to give back and help. But also, you have a very robust career and you have a life that you need to nurture and take care of yourself, right?
Yeah.
How do you balance all of that? What's your?
It was easier when Rebecca was around. It was easier, I have to say, because it was a partnership.
Yeah.
And she felt as passionately about the things that I feel passionately about, and she had her own interests as well. But sometimes it's especially difficult. But I don't know. I think it's just not holding on to negativity. Like I said earlier, life is too good. I say that because I was at a diner once, and this old Greek guy, I forget what we were talking about, but I said, life's too short. And he went, no, my friend, life is too good. And I thought, oh, gosh, that's a whole new perspective for me.
It is. It's beautiful.
And it was simple, but that's how I've been through so many weird things over the course of my life.
Yeah.
And my way of dealing with it is just to persevere, just to keep going and deal with whatever difficulties are thrown your way in the moment, and then not hold on to them, and then move forward. That's the way I deal with it.
I think that's such an important thing to remember, that if you live in the anger or in the hurt or in the disappointment instead of where you might be able to move forward with positivity and the goodness that's in your life, it can really eat you up.
Yeah. Also, I keep mentioning my wife was such a huge influence on my life, obviously, and I loved her so dearly. Mm-hmm. But the thing, her passing, besides grief, taught me that I want to live as much as possible and make an impact and do good things while I'm here, because we never know how long we're going to be here. You know, you might as well enjoy it and have a good time and say the things that need to be said. It's what I've said to my kids their entire life. When you're faced with something, with some kind of difficulty, make the loving choice. Mm. That's what I've told them. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, and that's what I try to do.
Let's talk about some of the things that bring you joy these days. What brings you joy?
My son just got engaged.
Yay.
Yeah, my older son, Alex, just got engaged to a wonderful gal named Abby. And Rebecca loved her, and I love her, and I love her parents, and I'm just crazy about her, and I'm crazy about them together. So that is bringing me joy currently. My friends bring me joy. It's like some people, they go, I have a couple of friends. I have so many friends, and I feel so lucky.
Yeah.
I really do, and I love what I do.
Yeah.
And I love walking down the street and having people go, hey, nice job, or whatever. It's very sweet. There's nothing bad about, of course, I was just in Toronto shooting something, and nobody knows who you are, and that's great, too. So I have this thing where I can just do whatever I want, and anywhere I go, it's just lovely.
Yeah.
But in New York, it's my home, and it's a very special place for me, and I live here, and I get to do everything that I ever wanted to do when I was a kid. All I wanted was to be a working actor. I didn't care at all about fame or money or anything like that. Obviously, when you're an actor, you can't care about money. You're going to suffer most of the time that way. But I just have always wanted to do this. And I just wanted a wife and kids and a home and maybe a car if I could afford. I got those things. And I feel incredibly lucky. And my parents are still going strong, and they're wonderful people, and my brothers. And I've been very blessed, despite everything that has gone on in my life. I feel terribly blessed. I really do.
Yes, we're blessed to know you.
Oh, hell.
We are. Do you have any favorite stories of favorite shows that you want to share with us today? Or on the subject of joy?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Should have prepped me for this.
I know, I didn't prep. This happens, I know. I prep people that I'm interviewing with.
I've told this story, and he knows it already. It's terrible. Sorry, Matthew Morrison, sorry. I'll say it out loud beforehand. We were doing South Pacific, but I love the story for a different reason. We were doing South Pacific, and he came out as Lieutenant Cable in these great glasses, aviator glasses, and he looked like the shit. He was fantastic. He looked great. And he walks out, and we've just sang Nothing Like a Dame, and he's in, and he's supposed to change the trajectory of the show. And he's supposed to come in and talk about he's on a special mission, and he's there to find this guy named Emile Debec, who's a French planter. He's scanning the area, and he comes out, and it's obvious he has no idea where he is. And I go, hey, Lieutenant, because I see his stripes. Hey, Lieutenant, how's it going? He says nothing. He says, I'm good. And sometimes it's this scary thing. You think, oh, God, if somebody forgets their line, what are you going to do? How would I react? And instead of being nervous at all, I had the exact opposite reaction. I thought, how are we going to get out of this?
Yeah.
This is going to be, oh, my God. Then how can I help you? I said to him, and he goes, I don't know. I said, welcome to this island. We've got lots of things here. We've got shrunken heads. We've got grass skirts if you want them. I said, up on top of that mountain, we've got some French planters. And he goes, yeah, French planter. French planter, yeah, French planter. I said, there's one over there. His name is Emile Debec. Emile Debec, yes. That's it. And then we got back on track.
Oh, my God, it took that long, though.
But it took, It took a while. But it was great, too. It was such a wonderful moment. And actually, I think he would say the same. It was just, we worked it out together.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun.
It really was.
Live theater.
Yeah.
2.5 years of doing that show, anything and everything could happen,
yeah.
And it usually did. About a month before we closed, I found a new laugh, right?
Yeah.
And that felt great. I loved doing that show very much. I really did. Yeah.
Yes, you were wonderful.
That. Yeah, I think that's my go-to story.
That's your go-to story.
I usually don't tell it out loud in a place like this.
What's the longest run you've ever done?
That was it, two and a half years. Yeah, I worked on Moulin Rouge for a while. Thank you. Very kind of you. Yeah, for a while. We did.
Yeah, over time.
Did it out of town, right. And then back in New York, and then the pandemic, right. And then we came and then came back.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
How was it to come back when you relaunched?
Oh, it was wonderful. Yeah, because everybody wanted to be in that theater so badly after the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
It was so hard on everybody.
Yes.
Everybody has their own pandemic stories,
right.
And it was incredibly difficult and emotional, and coming back was just, it was heaven, it really was. I didn't know, they told me when I opened the curtain that I got a standing ovation. I had no idea, because I couldn't, you're in the spotlight, you're blinded, but it was very sweet and very moving. For all of us.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, so I'm just looking at I'm just trying to clock everything.
Oh, good, yes.
I know.
And you're doing it so beautifully,
by the way. I took you on all of these kind of tangents, but that's because I wanted to talk to you about everything.
Because you're amazing.
Oh, you're amazing.
You're great at that.
I
love you. She's one of the nicest human beings. And brilliant writer and actress, a gorgeous singer.
Thank you. So we're going to start wrapping up soon. Do you have any words of wisdom that you would like to share with these beautiful people that have come to listen to you speak? About anything.
Really. About anything. I mean, when I was a young actor, and it applies to almost any subject, when I was a young actor doing summer stock at the Muni in 1986, I want to say, I did Around the World in 80 Days with Tony Randall and Robert Clary, who is LeBeau on Hogan's Heroes, if you remember him, and Leilani Jones.
Oh, wow.
There were a lot of wonderful people in the show. And I had this wonderful role opposite Tony. And he told me, it was our first day of rehearsal, and he was a hero of mine. I grew up in New York watching The Odd Couple on TV. I loved both he and Jack, and all of a sudden I found myself alone with him, sitting on the Muni in these big stages, just the two of us. And he said, we'll be doing a lot of work together. And I said, yes, we will. He said, so tell me about yourself. I said, about to get married and about to go to grad school in San Diego. And he said, graduate school for what? I said, for theater. He said, so you'll be able to teach acting? And I said, yes, I'll be able to teach acting. He said, if you had an acting class in front of you right now, what would you tell them was the most important part of acting? And I was so terrified. I was like, he was my hero. I was so green, too. I didn't know anything. And I said, my favorite acting teachers always said that acting is doing and acting is reacting. And he went, listening. And I said, oh, that's very much a part of reacting, don't you think? He said, don't argue with me, you asshole. He said, you should get down on your knees and thank me for telling you this. And then he stood up and went, it takes 10 years to learn how to listen. 10 years. And then walked away. And I thought, that was wonderful and I have a story for the rest of my life. But I also have to say, he was absolutely right that listening is the most important part of acting, because then you're ready for anything on stage. You're ready when somebody forgets a line. You're ready when someone changes a line. You're ready when something happens in the audience. You're just ready because you're in the moment, because you're not thinking about, oh God, what's my next line? What do I move over here? You're actually listening to what's going on and you're telling the story in the best way possible. And that it truly makes you a better artist. But I would also say that it makes you, getting back to all of what we've been talking about today, it makes you a better human being because you're able to hear the other person. Thank you, Tony Randall. Yeah.
Thank you, Danny Burstein. It's been such a joy
to share
space with you. And thank you from the bottom of my heart for your generosity, for being so open and the incredible human that you are.
Thank you.
We love you.
Thank you. I love you too. Love you.
Thank you for joining us. This episode was produced by Amy Von Masick and me, Christine Toy Johnson. Our music was composed by Andrea Daly. The Dramatists Guild Presents Talkback is a production of the Dramatists Guild of America and distributed by the Broadway Podcast Network. Let us know what you thought about the episode by using hashtag DGTalkback. As always, to be continued.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor, and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There is enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.